Well, to conclude the sort of formal session of today, I'm just going to reflect a bit on where I think we've got to. And interestingly, so much of what's in my slides I'm talking about have been covered today. So in fact, I'm going to go quite rapidly through some of the material because I don't want to labour points I think that we've all already shared. Before I go into this, I do want to just make two announcements briefly. One is, and I think everyone's pretty much aware of this, is that LAMS 2.1 is now officially out, and we can call this the official launch of LAMS 2.1 because we hadn't had any official moment for that. So I'm very glad to see that happen. The other one is, and just to let some of you know, we have had various LAMS partners around the world, and I'm pleased to announce that we will have a new partner in the US. Solution Grove is a company in the US that does support free learning, and they've just become our latest LAMS partner, so people in the US will have a local presence. And tomorrow I'm hoping that we will also be signing an agreement with the University of Cadiz here about support in Spain. So just to let you know, two announcements from the world of LAMS. The title I gave for this one was, are we ready for mass adoption of learning design? Have we reached a point where we think it could go much broader than just the specialists who've looked at it at the moment? And what I want to touch on in discussing that really is just what I think the vision is for this whole area. Why would we bother to focus on this? I almost dread to ask the question, what is learning design again? Because it's such a regular problem. But I want to use that because I think I want to draw out three different ways of thinking about learning design. And if we are not clear on those, we will pick the wrong bits of the problem that we're going to look at. And I want to then touch on what challenges do I think we have overcome in the last sort of 5 or 6 years in this field, and what remains yet to be done, and then conclude with a few of my own just personal thoughts about where we're up to. For me, this is sort of the vision. This is the thing that I hope we might achieve within learning design and, given today's discussion, particularly with a focus on formal learning context. And that is that if educators can together agree on how they describe good teaching and learning activities, good sequences, good lesson plans, whatever words we use for that, the good ideas about how students will learn, if we can agree on how we describe them and then capture them in a way that can run with computers, what we could call digital lesson plans, having done that sort of descriptive effort, then we can share them with each other, and that we can share good ideas as educators. And from that, then other educators can take them, they can adapt them, they can localize them, they can improve them. And so ultimately, as a collective effort of educators, we can describe good activities which we work on together and share and improve and develop as a kind of global body of knowledge of great ways of doing teaching and learning, and that anyone is then free to take and use that, to adjust it and to modify it. And while I've used educators here as the driver, this should equally apply to students. They should also be able to take it, modify it, make suggestions to their teachers and so on as part of a global effort to openly and freely develop, to share, to improve, to localize good ideas for teaching and learning. That for me is the kind of fundamental driver of why I work in this area. And while it's a very big goal and one that we still have so much distance to cover before it might be achieved, it seems to me to be a worthy goal. If this were possible, it would greatly change the world. It may not be possible, or it may be that what really happens is much different from this, but that dream to me still seems one that at least I feel strongly about and is worth believing in. So with that as a kind of backdrop then, let me talk a little bit about where I think learning design is at. And I want to draw out three different ways of thinking of this phrase, learning design. One is learning design as a descriptive framework. It's a way of describing the teaching and learning process, the activities that people go through when they do teaching and learning together. We are trying to get a language to describe that process. And so that's one way we can look at it. The second one is as learning design software, software systems that instantiate the ideas of this framework in a way that actually, runs things. But also, and I think particularly out of some of the talk today, we also think of learning design more as the advice we would like to give to our teaching colleagues to help them have more effective teaching and learning, more effective ideas and so on. And so it is not a descriptive language, it is not a piece of software, but more a practice and a community and a process about how do we together as educators, come up with better ideas and work together on those. So I want to draw out each of those three just briefly, because I think the kind of descriptive idea also has two dimensions. There's been the technical work on this. So IMS Learning Design, Educational Modeling Language, LDL and others are all attempts at some technical language that represents the teaching and learning process. But we also have sort of non-technical or more general or narrative versions of this. You know, a structured lesson plan is just an example of a way to write down what happens in teaching and learning. Educational patterns are another. And so I think what is behind this idea of learning design as a framework, as a notational system, as a language, is this concept that we could describe many different types of pedagogical approaches. There are many ways that you can do teaching and learning, you know, problem-based learning, role plays, instructivist, and so on. There are many of those. What we're trying to get is some general underlying framework that can describe many different types of pedagogical approaches, but from a common descriptive basis. And this has been described in some of the learning design literature as an attempt to make learning design pedagogically neutral. And it's always such a great provocative term. You know, it's rare that I've seen anyone say, oh yes, that's fine. I'm perfectly happy with the concept of pedagogical neutrality. You know, most people find it a very provocative term. I don't think that's something we can easily achieve, but the idea behind this, that is a descriptive framework that could describe many pedagogies, that I think is something that is still certainly worth aspiring to. And it's interesting because in some ways this concept, if we could describe teaching and learning in a sort of reproducible and shareable way, that has the most significant, the deepest potential to transform what we do in teaching and learning. But it's also one of the hardest ideas to understand. It's extremely hard to convey to a typical teacher, someone who doesn't work in the learning design field, what it is we're talking about when we talk about a framework for describing the process. So this remains one of our very great challenges. And I hate to reuse a slide from my talk last year, but I've found that this is, at least for some people, this is one that works. And that is in the history of music notation, as people tried to write down music, there was a period where there were these kind of insufficient or partial attempts to write down music, where it captured a bit of what music was, but not with enough information that another person could then reproduce, you know, to sing or to play that piece of music with any kind of accuracy or fidelity. And so the one on the left exists from sort of around about, I think it's 12, 1300, and there is some information there, but there is not yet enough to describe kind of how to reproduce that. And certainly I have a bit of a musical background. I mean, look at the left. Basically, my reaction is I have no idea how that sounds. Okay, I can't reproduce that for you, no matter how much time you give me, because there's not enough information in the system of notating music. But when I look at the one on the right, which is from hundreds of years ago, it's from Bach describing a piece. For me, when I look at that, I know exactly what Bach's intent was. And if you give me enough time sitting at a piano, I could eventually reproduce that for you. And so what had happened was in the history of music, there was a period where it moved to enough descriptive information, enough ideas about how to convey music, that for me, hundreds of years later, looking at something that Bach wrote down, I know Bach's intent. And I could, if I wanted to, enough time, reproduce that musical experience. And so I think at some very fundamental level, we are still struggling towards a notational language for education that is not comprehensive. We don't have to describe every possible thing, but we want to describe enough of what happens in the teaching and learning process that if you gave that to another teacher, and in the case of music, another teacher hundreds of years from now, they could still replicate the kind of teaching and learning environment, or at least look at it and then do something with it, because there was enough information. And it's worth noting that this does not mean that we describe everything. You know, when someone else plays a piece of music, if I were to play that piece, I would still bring my interpretation to it. I would still play it in ways different from the original author. I might, if I was, you know, particularly competent, even consider modifying or adapting bits of it. So we're not saying that we have to describe every possible bit of teaching and learning or education, but we want to describe enough of it so you could convey it to another person so that they knew the intent and could replicate it if they chose. That's my best attempt, at least so far, to try and capture what I think it is we're doing at a sort of very fundamental level with learning design. And I think we have a long way to go. I think we still need to learn a lot about what is the essence of describing the teaching and learning processes to get to the same point that music got to. The only thing that gives me some hope, and I said this last year, is it took hundreds of years for music to develop a sufficient notational system that then remained stable for many hundreds of years. So maybe it doesn't matter if it takes a long time to get this right. Obviously, we then have learning design as pieces of software. LAMS and many others are examples of this, and as we all know, they kind of arose from a certain unhappiness or the limitations of course management systems, and particularly the need for collaborative activities as a rich part of what goes on. You know, when you look at a SCORM object, it describes, you know, how a single learner progresses through that content, but collaboration is completely missing from the way SCORM looks at e-learning. And so while this is now 5 or 6 years ago, it was one of the primary drivers for this area of work. And underneath this, I want to draw something out, and that is a course management system is a radically different piece of software to a learning design system. A learning design system is at its heart a workflow engine that manages a sequence of tasks over a group of people. A course management system is actually a kind of website management tool for a number of restricted groups that people get, you know, classes that people get into. And just at a very fundamental technological level, these are very different kinds of systems. And I think it's worth reflecting on that and as to why perhaps learning design has been challenging to build, because it's not actually like the other technologies we've become familiar with in this area. And then just finally, sort of the dimension of learning design in terms of pedagogy. I mean, what we are trying to do in this perspective on learning design is not build software, it's not some notational system. We're just trying to say, how do we help colleagues, how do we work with other teachers, other educators, to suggest good ideas or to propose things they might want to try in their teaching and learning based on advice we might have about the way students learn or good pedagogy or activities that have worked well in other contexts that they might want to consider. And the thing I want to draw out of this is that this is where pedagogical neutrality, or whatever equivalent that we think of, is not the issue. In fact, it's quite the reverse. In this area, we are really interested in what is effective for learning. What would be a good design? What would be a good set of activities in this context for learning, as opposed to what is a general framework for description that makes no comment about what is good or bad pedagogy. And so I think these three different dimensions of the sort of learning design area are things we need to keep in mind when we try and tease out what's going on. And just in a very simple way, I think these all interplay in making sense of this field. So that's my sort of attempt to parse out the pieces of learning design. And then if I can just talk briefly about the challenges using these three categories that we've overcome and also where we're going. I think on the descriptive framework, we have, you know, as a community done some amazing work. IMS Learning Design, EML and others give us examples that we can describe, you know, in a technical framework how this happens. And also more generally, you know, things like the AUTC Learning Design Project, which gave us a kind of graphical way of describing these activities, some of the work that Compendium is doing now and others. These are all attempts to help us think about it. So I think we've actually made significant progress about some way of describing what happens in teaching and learning processes. And also we're starting to be able to see the idea that a single description might be used to run face-to-face processes or online processes, and that that is a separate decision from the description itself. You know, LAMS does not have to be just about e-learning. LAMS can be a description of activities where the second step in the sequence might be to debate a topic. Whether you debate that in a chat room and run it with LAMS, or whether you debate it face-to-face with no technology at all, is a kind of a separate issue from capturing the design itself. And so I think we're starting to move beyond seeing this area as just about e-learning and being more about teaching and learning generally, of which implementation with technology is, you know, one option, but not sort of required. I think on the software, perhaps one of the lessons, and very few people say this, but building learning design software is appallingly difficult. It has turned out to be a much harder software problem than I think any of us had hoped. You know, the number of projects who've tried to build software in this area and have found it challenging, if not impossibly challenging, is in fact very large. And the fact that LAMS has got to the point it has, you know, do not underestimate that. LAMS has had millions of dollars of funding to get where it is and had to completely rebuild the system from the ground up, you know, halfway through its life. And so we, you know, LAMS may have got a certain distance, but don't think that that means it was easy or cheap. It was, in fact, very difficult and very complex. Nonetheless, we have got a certain distance now, and not only with LAMS, we have other systems as well that have made good progress in this area. I won't sort of reiterate all the particular features of LAMS, but I think we have learning design software. It works. We can do these things to at least a certain level now. One thing that I do want to draw out is there are a couple of features in LAMS which have turned out to be very important for the practical implementation of the sort of teacher experience. And one of them is that if you can press a preview button when you're in authoring and immediately see what your students would see, and then say, oh no, that's actually not what I meant, close it, completely rearrange it, hit preview again, and immediately see it again and go, yeah, that's closer, but maybe not. And so this very rapid iteration between what the students would see and the design you're doing, that has proved to be very important for the experience of teachers trying to do learning design. But it took a lot of underlying technology to make it sort of possible that you could, you know, hit preview and it would work. And so that feature, together with this idea that the tools would be automatically set up for you, if you want a forum at step three and the question is why is the sky blue, that will just happen automatically based off the authoring that you've done. Again, there was all sorts of work under the hood needed to make that happen, but it mattered for the ease with which people could, you know, sort of try out this learning design approach. And a final one that's often overlooked, but every time I go out in the field, you know, in real schools and with you know, universities who are using LAMS, students say that the fact that they get stepped through the task is actually something they really value because they know where they're meant to be and what they're meant to do next, and they don't get lost. The learning design system where all the activities are there, but they're not somehow coordinated, and you have to kind of keep coming and going and trying to get to the right spot. It turns out for many students, just at a very practical kind of level, being stepped through the tasks matters a lot to them, sort of having a feel of where they are in the activities. Now, I don't want to suggest that's always the case. You know, in some of the examples Stephen gave, this would not be the appropriate way to do it. But certainly LAMS as we know it today and the kind of sequence flow of activities, the stepping through the tasks tends to turn up again and again from a student perspective as being something that made quite a difference to their experience of this. And again, I don't want to labour really anything about the particular LAMS software today, but the branching features in 2.1 have now allowed us to have additional flexibility about what different students do with different tools or different groups. And that has taken us now a long way forward from where we were before, where effectively all students kind of went together one way or another through the sequence. Now we have much greater ability to say, well, this group might do this or this group might do that and so on. So in terms of providing more support for a richer range of pedagogies, you know, more flexibility, this has been a very significant step forward for us. Again, it turned out to be very challenging to do in software, but now that it's in place, it will hopefully help us. And I've got to say already, I mean, it's only very early days, but I've been astonished at the speed with which even people who are very new to LAMS grab this feature and run with it and do amazing things with it very quickly, that somehow people understand what branching means very rapidly and, you know, sort of do amazing things. So we will see more over the next year as this becomes more widely adopted, but I already have a sense that it is surprising just how much people are sort of grabbing this dimension quickly. And then finally, in terms of the challenges I think we've overcome on the sharing level, you know, the sharing of effective pedagogy, you know, we have the LAMS community and that provides repository and discussion. The AUTC Learning Design Project has had a great website of exemplars and so on. And so, yes, these things have happened. We can share learning designs. That's all been effective. But one of the lessons already from this that I've talked about at other times is we don't see very much direct reuse. You know, as far as I know, not a lot of people go to the LAMS community, pull out a sequence and go, right, I'll run this sequence, and off they go. Happens sometimes, but not very, very often. But what we have heard a lot of people talk about is a kind of inspiration, that by looking at other people's sequences, they say, oh, that's a nice idea. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. I'll use that next time I'm building a sequence. Or I really like the way they put that tool with that tool. That little bit of, you know, thinking about how a design might work is an idea I want to reuse. So that has certainly come through as a fairly strong benefit of what we had. It's not the benefit we thought the people would take from the sharing of designs, but you know, that's what we're hearing from the community in practice. And the other one, and this is not so much about the sharing of designs, but a byproduct of the actual systems, there's been quite a bit of feedback to say that sort of the more activity-centric way that learning design systems work, you know, they don't focus just on building SCORM content or its equivalent. They actually sort of encourage you to think about activities, you know, forum, chat, you know, and so on. And so that has led some teachers, some educators, to try out perhaps more activities than they might have done before. And so it's sort of the affordances of the system, the ease with which you could give that a go, that you could try it, has had some impact on the way people have experienced learning design. So that's, I think, some of the things that as a field we can be pleased about what we've achieved. In terms of the challenges that remain, well, there are many of them. Technically, and again, I don't want to go into too much detail, but there are still a lot of issues to work out about the underlying technology of how things work, how tools get set up or invoked, the different nature of properties. We still don't have any kind of easy interoperability. I mean, there's no two systems which are so mature that you can pull out one sequence from one and run it in another. We're not quite there yet. Equally, on the descriptive side, I still think if you said to a teacher, all right, you have no more than one page to describe what you did in your class today so that another teacher who could do the same thing, what would you write down? What would be the most important information to put on a single page that would allow another teacher to do it, as opposed to interesting and extra information that, while interesting, is not essential to replicating the experience? And I think, back to the music notation example, we still don't quite know yet what are the critical pieces in terms of conveying from one teacher to another the good ideas about, what I taught today. So I think we still have much work to do there. On the software side, well, there's a very long list of features. Everywhere I go, people always have amazing ideas. I still think that the question of what we've sometimes called deep integration with course management systems, where you could have the sort of drag and drop authoring of LAMS, you could have the underlying sequencing engine, but the actual activity tools would be the tools you're used to in your course management system, the forum, the chat, and so on. You wouldn't have to use a new set of tools in LAMS, you'd be able to use the ones in your LMS. And unfortunately, that is still a significant piece of technical work, and none of the sort of course management system providers have yet gone that step. I think also one that's come up is support for less linear structures, be it looping, be it game environments. There's still a long way to go there, and I think some of this will be very challenging. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, it's just some hard work to come. And I also think some of the concepts that in fact date back to the very early days of learning design about role-enabled tools, the idea that for a chat, I might hand to one of the students the role of moderating the chat instead of me, the teacher, assuming that I would always moderate. This is an area that's still, there's a great deal more work that could be done in that field. So, that's some of the technical and language challenges, but I actually think that the really big challenge, the one we are yet to solve, is the sharing of effective designs. That is, in fact, the bit that exercises my mind most. And if we are to see mass adoption of learning design, we have to somehow crack this problem. And the thing is that we know many pieces of this problem. We still don't know how to put them together. It's what mixture of the right platforms, the right tools, activity tools like forums, the right advice, how should you configure your course? How should you run this week's activities? The right identification of learner needs. The students struggle learning this information because of a particular problem, and hence, because of that problem, this sort of activity would be good for them to try to overcome those misunderstandings. What kind of communities of sharing would be right? Would the CloudWorks be the right sort of approach? Would LAMS community, all these things. Also, what kind of design templates, what pre-built templates with good structures in them would be right? Or even what fully built, ready-to-use sequences with all content and all structure all in place. All of these things might be critical to crystallizing mass adoption, or more likely, some very nuanced clustering of some of these and not others will be the tipping point that would drive this forward. And the challenge to me, and I think for many individuals, we just don't know which clustering, which nuanced set of these would be the thing that really pushed this field ahead. It is worth saying, though, that the problem might not be the right configuration of the parts. It may be other problems elsewhere. It may be the teachers are not rewarded for sharing and reuse, and so they won't do it very much. It may be, as Stephen's reminded us, if the environment is too teacher-centric and teacher-controlling, then the students may not engage, and so we won't get very far. It may be that we still don't have the evidence that going to all this effort actually produces great educational outcomes. The no significant difference problem remains a great challenge. If we can't prove that this makes a difference, then why would all our colleagues listen to us? Why would they go to the effort? It might be people still have concerns about sharing and intellectual property. So there's all these other contextual factors that may also prove to be critical as to whether we can get mass adoption going or not. And you know, I don't have any simple answer to this, but as we've often discussed today, it feels like if the answer is not on that slide, it would surprise me. But which bit of that slide or which clustering of pieces on that slide would tell us either this is how we get mass adoption of learning design or it was not going to happen, but why it was not going to happen. That seems to be the challenge. So one of the things, so to sort of wrap up today, I want to just give you a few of my personal thoughts and where we are going in our own work on this. One of them is the LAMS Activity Planner. I talked about this a year ago, but we were unable to get funding to get started on this project. Finally, this just happened, and Leanne Cameron will be leading much of this work over the next year or two. And we're going to try and put together a sort of a library of good templates. These are sort of good activity structures, but not necessarily with any content in them. We want to have some kind of decision process where teachers can look at a range of options with advice and choose, oh yes, this sort of template would suit what I want to do. And then we want to make it much easier to do the editing of these templates, particularly focusing on content editing rather than changing all the pedagogical structure. And we also, if we can, having done this, we would like to provide the software so anyone else could create their own activity planner. You know, you could have your own set of templates and your own decision process and your own editing. If you haven't seen it, and I'm not going to go into detail, this is a screenshot of, you know, here are a range of different templates that a teacher might want to consider. And having considered and looked at those, where they would get to would be a page where most of the template, most of the LAMS sequence here has already been pre-configured. But what you would just edit is just the key bits of content. You know, what question would you like the students to answer? What website or what document would they look at? You know, what should they reflect on when they write in their notebook? And so you would only fill in, you know, a couple of lines of text for each activity, which is the core content, and then you're ready to run this sequence. And so while many of us in this room would not, you know, need to use this because you could use the full sort of authoring environment, this may be something that helps a much broader range of teachers who are not going to invest the time to learn all of the authoring of learning designs. And yet if they found a template and said, oh yeah, I quite like that, I'd be willing to give that structure a go, could then say, right, well, my question for today is this, and my website I want to look at is this. And that would be done on one single page. You'd do it in under 5 minutes, and you'd be ready to run something with your students. So this may or may not be the right decision, but we're going to have a crack at this one and see what we get as feedback when we try and take this out to a broader range of teachers, not just those who sort of already work in learning design. I think to just sort of conclude some of my, I suppose, my gut feelings about where we're at in this field. And one of them is that I actually think we have enough learning design technology. There's still a huge amount we could do, and there's still many features I would like to add. But we now, in fact, have quite a bit of good technology that could do many different things, you know, if we pushed it to the limit. I do think, though, that radical ease of use remains key. There is still a huge amount we could do to make it really simple to take the benefits of these kind of approaches, so that many teachers could try it out, not just the specialists. So I do feel that strongly. For me, when I think back to my days of teaching introductory psychology, which is my background, and I think of my colleagues in that context, I think what they wanted was something that would help them with a few good ideas in their otherwise very busy lives. And so to try and get a system or an activity planner in this case, which assumed, look, you're not going to give me very much time, but if I could give you a few quick and obviously useful things to try out with your class, you might give them a go. That, you know, that really is the thing. And so an activity planner which thinks about, like, says, all right, here are some activities which are great if you've got 20 minutes in a computer lab and you want to try something out. Or here are some activities which are great to do between two tutorials that are 1 week apart. So you had two face-to-face tutorials and you want to do some asynchronous activities in between. Well, here's some that are good for that. You know, here's a 5-minute activity you could run in a lecture if students were willing to have a go with a mobile device and respond. Very sort of contained specific cases, which are not, you know, all the fanciest pedagogy we can imagine, but would be focused on trying to find the hook for a busy educator who'd say, oh yeah, that one, I'd give that a go. And so that seems to me to be one of the things to try. And within that, to just take the literature we know about various good teaching ideas, you know, the various structures and approaches you can do in small group teaching, to try and take those into an advice context which says, all right, depending on your constraints, here's some good ideas, would you be willing to try them? That, I don't want to suggest this is the most revolutionary idea, but it seems to me to be something that would be worth a shot to see whether it leads to a wider adoption of the learning design approach. I also have a suspicion that activity planners which have complete discipline content in them might in fact also have a place. When I think back to my psychology days, if I was to put together an activity planner that had, I don't know, the 20 most common activities or experiments that you would teach in an introductory psychology course and had them all completely built and ready to run, so that a colleague who's, you know, teaching psychology could look and say, oh, I'll pick that experiment, you know, number 7, that's one I'd like to run, and be able to get that and be able to use it. But also with the simple editing environment. So if they looked at it and they said, oh, that's good, but I don't like your website, I would use a different website to make this point. Or I don't like the article you chose, I want to switch your article. So even though it's a fully prepared set of activities, that simple authoring page, the one-page authoring, would still allow the person to say, oh, no, I'd like to tweak the way the question is asked, or I'd like to swap out the resource. I'm not sure, but I have a suspicion that that might also get us a new range of people. I also think that it's worth reflecting on the textbook publishers in this context, because the great example of reuse of educational content that happens every day is textbooks. You know, we have someone or a small number of people write a textbook on introductory psychology or whatever it might be, and then hundreds or thousands of other lecturers use that in their courses. Now, they may use it a lot or only a little bit, but if we're looking for examples of reuse in education, we have a billion-dollar industry built on that idea. But what's funny is that industry has been built pretty much on the printed textbook. We haven't seen very much yet that's more activity-driven. And so I wonder if and when we will see a shift or interest to what activities might be built in the same kind of way in the past that a written textbook was built. And, you know, who knows, I don't have any particular agenda on this, but I would say that we don't need all publishers to do this. We just need one. You only need one publisher with a rich set of content to suddenly take an activity view, you know, to what they do, to add on to whatever they have at the moment, and you would suddenly have, you know, a huge new way of looking at the sharing of educational materials. The fact that you then have a second publisher who does their own set of activities which are kind of similar to the first ones, that doesn't add very much more that's new, but the jump from no publisher doing lots of shared activities to one of them having a go would be a very significant jump. So I still wonder about that one. Who knows whether we'll see it. And then lastly, this is my sort of final thought, is my experience of dealing with busy educators is sometimes as people who work centrally on educational design or who otherwise want to help busy educators, we assume that we can go in and kind of, as I put it, talk pedagogy to them up front, that we can ask them to rethink their courses, to change what they do, as sort of in our very first interaction with them. And I've seen far too many of my, you know, busy colleagues who are not into teaching and learning basically say, why would I want to have this discussion with you? I don't trust you yet. You know, you haven't earned the right yet to tell me how to teach differently. And I think we need to think a bit more about this kind of trust dimension, that if as people who have expertise in teaching and learning who would like to, you know, provide ideas or suggestions to our colleagues, that in fact that involves earning trust and, you know, sort of the willingness to talk about this rather than just assuming that one can do it. Now, there are exceptions to this. If you're building a new course from scratch, or you're doing a major redesign of a course, or if there's a course with known major problems, those are the times when, you know, the busy educator may be willing to have a serious discussion about it right up front. But in the other cases where it's a typical course running and, you know, you would want to provide some advice, my suggestion to this is, in fact, rather than starting with the big bang discussion, you actually aim for something small. You aim for just one activity or one week where you might do something a bit new, a bit innovative, a bit risky with them and see what they would be willing to do. Let that run out in implementation. You actually do it with students, and hopefully if it goes well, if it's an interesting experience, it's after that that you may then have earned the right to talk more generally about teaching, learning, you know, new, wider ideas. And so while this may not sort of, it may take time to get to the wider discussion, perhaps that's going to be important for, you know, certain category of educators where they are not willing to consider the big discussion up front, But if they had a good experience with a small thing that was new, then they might be willing to talk further. And so, I think back to my days teaching psychology. That feels true of many of my colleagues in the psychology department, that they would not have let me sit down and try and persuade them to change their entire course. But if I'd said, hey, you know this week three here where you try and do this activity, what about if you tried doing it this way that's a bit differently and a bit more open and, you know, allow students more freedom and so on? What about that? And if they said yes, having tried it and if the student experience went well, to then come back and say, well, that went well. What about some other ideas that you might want to consider in other parts of your course, in other things? I think that may have been that process may have been one that was more likely to succeed. So to, I suppose, conclude, are we ready for mass adoption of learning design? Well, yes. You know, we have technology, we have ways of thinking, we know that they work, and we have many examples now of success. You know, as Sarah was talking about earlier today, a number of projects funded in the UK have, you know, had some great things. So it's you know, yes is possible, but no. I actually don't think we're ready for mass adoption of learning design yet at the fundamental level. I think we still have some key things to sort out before we see the tipping point. And I think at the heart of that is this, for me, it's this kind of, if only we could work out the right sort of, you know, advice or the right templates or the right sets of tools, then we might see the tipping point. And if that is not it, then there is some problem in the wider context, which is really at the heart. If teachers are not yet rewarded for all this new effort and work, then perhaps we will not see mass adoption. So I don't know which of those, you know, is key, but I think the more we keep trying, the more different ways we come at the problem, and then tracking the evaluations of what is successful and what isn't, may tell us the what sounds like, you know, a very complex landscape to make it work, but nonetheless may get us there in the end. So thank you.